What do you do when both parents die within 32 days and you're suddenly responsible for raising your 8-year-old brother? Dave Eggers faced this question at 21, and his answer became one of the most innovative memoirs of the modern era. But this isn't a traditional grief narrative. It's something stranger and more honest, a book that simultaneously mourns and mocks itself, that performs its own vulnerability while questioning whether that performance cheapens the real pain underneath. The title announces this tension immediately, sincere enough to claim heartbreak and genius, self-aware enough to recognize how ridiculous that sounds. The story begins in a house that has become a factory of illness. His mother lies immobile on the couch, spitting green fluid into plastic containers, her body ravaged by cancer. Eggers describes the disease with visceral precision, 1,000 writhing worms with one blind evil eye, while maintaining an almost clinical tone about daily caregiving. This juxtaposition creates a disorienting effect. One moment he's helping with nosebleeds, the next he's noticing dated wallpaper slogans. The catastrophic and the trivial coexist in ways that feel absurd yet painfully real, mirroring how grief actually works, not as a steady descent into sadness, but as a chaotic oscillation between horror and mundane observation. After their parents' deaths, Dave and Tuff flee to California with a sense of entitlement born from suffering. "We are owed," he declares. "We are collecting on what's coming to us." They drive along Highway 1 while the Pacific Ocean seems to cheer for them. Yet this freedom comes with paralyzing responsibility. At the beach, Dave watches Toph near the dangerous surf, his mind conjuring vivid drowning scenarios. Their relationship defies easy categorization. When Toph builds sandcastles and expects payment, a tradition their mother started, it's simultaneously touching and absurd. Dave teases him relentlessly, predicting he'll inherit protruding nipples and terrible acne. Their elaborate frisbee games become moments of transcendence, their athletic grace drawing admiration from strangers. Dave imagines them as perfection, harmony, young and live, their movements expressing a freedom their circumstances deny. Yet beneath every perfect throw lies constant anxiety about money, stability, and survival. House hunting reveals their diminished circumstances. After spacious Chicago homes and beautiful Berkeley sublets, they face cramped apartments and suspicious landlords. One man looks stricken upon seeing them, refusing to show the property after learning their ages. Desperate, they find a small adobe house where Dave offers his only advantage, paying the entire year's rent up front. They repaint everything in 1 week. Light blue family room, deep burgundy living room, salmon bedroom, skipping corners for a fuzzy Rothko-esque finish. For Toph's 10th birthday, Dave paints huge superheroes on his bedroom walls for decoration and protection. But their home descends into chaos, the coffee table becoming purgatory for everything eaten, worn, or broken. Dave worries constantly that authorities will discover their slovenly lifestyle and take Toph away. Their household operates on deliberately flexible rules. When Dave doesn't want to do something, he claims he's not actually his parent. But when someone needs blame, Toph takes responsibility. By mid-fall, they establish a chaotic routine. Toph wakes at 3 or 4 a.m. to shower, dress, eat breakfast, finish homework, and watch cartoons for hours. Dave drives him to school perpetually late, writing honest excuse notes signed Brother of Chris. Their menu consists of 8 precisely defined meals: the saucy beefsteak, the crunchy chicken, the crumbling wall, with strict rules, no spices except oregano, raw vegetables only, always served with 1% milk. Their home life becomes a deliberate circus: sword fights with wooden spoons, water spitting chases, food thrown at each other. Dave consciously creates a music video atmosphere of fun, fun, fun to counterbalance Beth's photo albums and emotional check-ins. At school events, Dave oscillates between feeling pathetic and glamorous, imagining them as celebrities, orphans from a place where there are still orphans. When curious parents approach, they perform their well-rehearsed script about their parents' deaths, Dave always ending with, "Well, what are you gonna do?" A line that both diffuses tension and challenges pity. The past intrudes through devastating revelations. Dave's father maintained an elaborate deception during supposed sobriety, secretly disguising vodka in tall glasses of quinine water for nearly a year while attending AA meetings. The family, desperately wanting to believe, was flush with pride and hope, but he consumed more alcohol than before. The psychological impact manifested in Dave's wild, horror-infested imagination, lying awake convinced their downstairs had transformed into a sinister laboratory. The thin, brittle rope of trust snapped completely when Dave was 8, during the door thing. His father, heavily intoxicated, pursued him through the house until Dave barricaded himself in his bedroom. The terror remains crystallized, first attempting to call relatives, then desperately fashioning an escape rope from bedsheets. Suspended halfway out his second-story window, the door came in, an explosion of wood, and he was upon me. His mother's intervention possibly prevented serious harm, but the broken door remained unrepaired for 12 years, a daily physical reminder. When questioned about whether this constituted abuse, Dave deflects, "Oh God, no, he didn't spank us very hard." Yet he acknowledges developing a permanent flinch mentality and constant fear his father might accidentally kill one of them. Dave returns to Chicago in winter without a coat, not because he forgot one, but because he never thought to bring one. Despite having lived there for 100 years, he's freezing in just a cellophane pullover, physically disconnected from his past. His itinerary mixes the practical with the morbid, visiting his hometown, old flames, his father's secret bar, the funeral home, and his childhood home. The new owners have transformed everything. His old room is unrecognizable. Orange forest wallpaper gone, drawings gone, carpet gone, broken door replaced. Where his father's walk-in closet once stood, there's now a jacuzzi. "We put a lot of time into this house," the father says. "Yeah," Dave replies. "We kinda let things slide there for a while." At the funeral home, an employee unexpectedly discovers a box containing his mother's cremated remains that had never been delivered. On his final night, Dave takes them to the beach. Opening the container, he's surprised to find not fine ash, but multicolored pebble-like fragments. As he scatters handfuls into Lake Michigan, he spills some onto the rocks and his clothes, becoming frantic. He oscillates between seeing his actions as beautiful and loving and glorious, or small and disgusting, worrying that his self-awareness ruins any potential beauty in the act. The memoir concludes with Dave and Tuff driving toward Black Sands Beach, Tuff leaning out the window, mooing at tourists, until they're both in tears of laughter. They've skipped a mandatory high school entrance test, having decided to leave San Francisco for New York. On the beach, they continue their frisbee game with increasingly complex tricks. Dave's desperate plea for recognition culminates in raw vulnerability. "Don't you know that I am connected to you? Don't you know that I'm trying to pump blood to you?" This outburst encapsulates the memoir's central tension between wanting connection and fearing it, between performing grief and authentically experiencing it. The frisbee becomes their perfect metaphor, each throw requiring trust, each catch a small triumph against gravity and loss. When tragedy strips away everything familiar, you find a brother, a beach, and a plastic disc spinning through the air. Survival isn't about transcending pain, but learning to live inside it, throwing and catching, over and over, suspended in that moment of perfect flight before the inevitable descent. And somehow, impossibly, that's enough.